Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Andrew Watsky, art historian and professor of art at Vassar College, who will be talking with us about his book entitled Shikibushima, Deploying the Sacred Arts in Momoyama, Japan. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You must be quite pleased that your book has received not one but two prestigious book awards, the Association for Asian Studies John Whitney Hall Award and the Smithsonian's Shimada Prize.
Yes, I was very surprised and happy to receive both of those. They do kind of cover different constituencies, so it was very surprising to get them.
It's a beautifully illustrated book.
It has a lot of color. There was a lot of photography that had never been published before. There was a special project, actually, to record the building back in the 90s, and a lot of that photography is actually in the book.
Both award committees mentioned that your book is much more than just an analysis of the specific architectural monument that is the central focus of your text, and that the wider religious, cultural, and historical context you bring into play and, in fact, illuminate in your reading of the structure make the book a fundamental introduction to Momoyama art in general. And I wondered, was this something you planned as you were writing the book, or is it just the way things fell together?
Well, to be honest with you, I really wasn't sure what I was going to find when I started, of course. What attracted me to the building initially was my interest in looking at Japanese art, not in terms of, say, only painting or sculpture, but it's always struck me that Japanese art, as many arts are, is a combination of many different mediums that joined together to create a single monument. And this particular one is a prime example of that and had been understudied, I think, precisely because of the fact that one by one, the individual mediums themselves don't add up to much until you look at them in relation to other things. Yeah. So it was only after I started working on the building and then on the island did I realize how many other things were actually involved in it that made it into what I hope was actually a good narrative, a good story.
But you didn't set out then just to write a textbook?
No, I certainly didn't, although by virtue of the fact that there are so many different mediums involved, it does become almost like a textbook because you have to cover so many different mediums.
Yeah. So could you talk about the island of Shikibushima a bit and its spiritual significance?
Well, it is an island that has a large presence in Japanese history from a very long time ago. Its spiritual significance has been fairly steady, really, from recorded time onwards, or at least back to the 8th century or so. We have records, perhaps a bit later than that. But even in prehistoric time, we have evidence that the island was seen as a sacred place. Right off the island, in the waters, they have found these accumulations of jomon, or early culture pots, that seem to have some kind of spiritual or ritual use. That suggests that maybe the island was viewed as a sacred place early on, but once Buddhism got a foothold in Japan, it seems as though the island, from an early time, has been a place where the deities were believed to dwell. And that got increasingly more well-defined over time, to the extent that it had both local significance in terms of what is known as the Lotus Festival, as well as more kind of national significance in terms of what the resident deity, Benzaiten, was thought to protect, which was indeed the nation. Mm-hmm. So it's had this both local and national significance until about the mid-19th century, which has kept it central, even though it's, at this point in Japan's history, rather peripheral.
So it's not thought of today as necessarily a sacred place.
Oh, it is. It is still very much a sacred place. Yeah. Pilgrims go there.
But tourists also.
Tourists go there as well. It's a very beautiful spot. But it does have a religious significance historically that has continued to attract people to it. What I mean is that it's not quite as central to the sacred fabric of Japan as it used to be, especially in the 16th century and earlier, 17th century and earlier.
Was there something about the island itself physically that lends itself to this kind of spiritual association?
Well, it is true that when you see this place, it's located in the largest lake in Japan, north of Kyoto, which had long been the capital of Japan, and even before Kyoto was the capital, that was considered to be the central part of Japan. And there aren't that many islands in this lake. There are some, But this particular island is in the northern part of the lake, and it has nothing immediately surrounding it. So it does kind of appear backgrounded against the mountains behind it on the mainland, and it seems to emerge from nothing.
Yeah.
It has a very distinctive shape, and it seems perfectly framed by everything that's around it. Now, whether that makes it sacred or not, it certainly stands out visually, and perhaps that contributed to people's perception of it as a place that was sacred.
Now, there is a Buddhist community on the island,
mm-hmm.
and was this a militarized community?
Unlike many, not many, but some Buddhist temples in Japan in the pre-modern period, it was never a militarized community per se, but it certainly allied itself with other power holders, either regionally or nationally. And so I guess you could say that it was implicated in some of the power struggles over time.
The community seems to have insulated itself from much of the destruction of the period of civil war in particular that preceded
mm-hmm.
the relatively mm-hmm. peaceful period of the Momoyama. So
mm-hmm.
whatever their alliances, they seem to have survived much better than many
absolutely.
Similar places on the mainland.
Well, in part it's because they were rather savvy about who they allied with. And they changed their alliances accordingly. And that really does, especially in the period that I write about in the book, that is the period when the most important alliances occurred and the ones that could have impacted the island the most, and did eventually. They allied themselves with a warrior who eventually ruled Japan very smartly and under threat. And because of that relationship, really benefited in the latter part of the 16th and early 17th century, which is when most of the buildings on the island remain from.
Unfortunately, there was a fire that destroyed the original temple
mm-hmm.
in the mid-16th century.
Yes, there had been a fire in the 16th century, which in a sense provided the excuse for some of the patronage that took place later on. Of course, fire, war, earthquakes have long plagued Japan, so many, many places in Japan have, over the course of their histories, faced real destruction. The place that I wrote about, or the building that I write about in the book, is one of the places that does remain from that post-fire, immediate post-fire period.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's a very unusual place. One of the arguments I make in the book, of course, is that part of that building was moved from Kyoto, and had that building not been moved from Kyoto, it probably would not have survived to the present day, because Kyoto itself in this period was ravaged by war and fire, and there was a lot of destruction.
That's one thing that strikes me about Japanese history in general. There was such destruction on a sort mm-hmm. of regular basis, it seems.
Well, yes, that's true, although it is also the case that for many of the major moments in time, we do have surprisingly well-preserved temple precincts, say from the 8th century, you know, even earlier. And this particular one is one of the great, I'd say, late 16th, early 17th century monuments to remain, small though it may be. It's one of the few intact ones that we have.
Now, with the accession of Nobunaga, the great warlord who ushers in the Momoyama period, Japan begins an era of relative stability. At least, things become more stable as Nobunaga consolidates power, and Shikibushima then passes into the hands of his deputy, Hideyoshi?
That's correct. At this point, Hideyoshi, who eventually becomes the ruler of Japan, is young, just coming into his own. This was his first real fief, the area near Shikibushima on the mainland. And this is one of those happy chances that occur that allowed Shikibushima to flourish later on. Nobunaga certainly threatened Shikibushima to ally with him or face the consequences. Shikibushima did ally with Nobunaga, and the local deputy Hideyoshi was the one who had basically administered this shift.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, it's very fortunate for Shikibushima that they made that choice. Who knows what would have happened otherwise. But also, they probably didn't realize, no one would have at that point, that Hideyoshi would eventually rule Japan. And indeed, that's what happened. And on the basis of a very close connection between the island and Hideyoshi that was fostered during this early period, Shikibushima really reaped the benefits later on. But it's also important to realize that Shikibushima as a place was one that was sought by these military rulers, such as Nobunaga, and then eventually Hideyoshi. Because of its sacred power, it was not a one-way street. These ruling warriors sought the protection and the power of these sacred places because they thought there would be some kind of benefit from linking with them. And clearly, there was some sort of religious activity that the warriors engaged in that was serious to the degree that we can assess it. But they did believe there was benefit to be allied with these places. And Chikubushima happened to be perceived to be a particularly powerful sacred place.
Can you talk about how political leaders like Nobunaga and Hideyoshi used then spirituality? And I'm thinking especially of the ritual of 1,000 monks that you mentioned, which seemed quite interesting.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a large answer to that question and then a more specific one. In general, all political leaders, basically throughout Japan's history, from very early on, from when we have records up to more recently even, you could talk about the importance, say, during World War II of Shinto and, and even Buddhism in the war effort, but that's another discussion. Back at this time, one of the ways that military rulers proved their own worth as political leaders was to do things that would benefit the nation, and the spiritual world was thought to be one that would have real efficacy. This is manifested through the patronage of temples and shrines throughout the nation. The 1,000-monk ritual that you mentioned earlier was one that Hideyoshi eventually took control of, and he used it not only as a means of gaining spiritual power, but also as a way of asserting his own power over the spiritual realm. What I mean by that is that it forced monks of different, say, Buddhist sects to come together in veneration under the auspices of Hideyoshi, and some of these sects were essentially at war with each other in terms of doctrine. So the fact that Hideyoshi could command and achieve a ceremony with all these different sects acting together was one of his ways of asserting power over them. So that is one of the ways that that worked. But on the other hand, these spiritual places were also perceived to offer real benefits. And in the case of Chikubushima, for example, one of the reasons why this attractive physical location that I described earlier was perceived to be so powerful spiritually was because of a geomantic understanding of the Japanese archipelago. The Buddhist sutras tell us that the most powerful enemies of Buddhism come from the north, the northeast, in fact. And if you look at a map of Japan and you look at Kyoto, northeast of Kyoto is exactly where Chikubushima is located. So in a sense, what they did was overlaid this spiritual map or geomantic map onto the actual geography of Japan and discovered, well, lo and behold, northeast of Kyoto, the capital of Japan, is precisely where Chikubushima is located. That is the spot where the most fearsome enemies come from in a spiritual sense. So that must be the place where certain Buddhist deities shall be placed or are placed in order to protect the,
protect the
capital.
The deities,
So that happened to be this deity Benzai Ten. And so it was good policy for people like Nobunaga and Hideyoshi to have close connections and offer money and other kinds of material support for the Buddhist and religious establishment on the island in order to gain the protection of the deity who was thought to reside there, Benzai Ten.
Oh, interesting. So in some sense, in a spiritual sense, this is a kind of military strategic decision to protect the southern part of the island's
archipelago. Well, to protect Kyoto.
Kyoto.
I mean, it's kind of a false thing to separate out the secular and the sacred very distinctly because they're so intertwined. And no political ruler at the time would perceive himself to be completely separate from looking at the sacred realm. And I think what is amazing about some of the things that happened in the Momoyama period is that Nobunaga especially, and then Hideyoshi, more so than previous rulers, made certain that the Buddhist establishment took care of spiritual matters in a very focused way. Whereas previously, some Buddhist institutions acted in ways that weren't entirely spiritual. They fielded armies, for example, and asserted themselves in military ways that were a threat to, say, more secular rulers such as Nobunaga and then Hideyoshi. One of the great changes that occurred in the 16th century through Nobunaga's efforts and then Hideyoshi's was to eliminate that, to a very large degree, that military side of religious institutions, and then to harness these religious institutions in terms of their spiritual power to help the political rulers to do the work of governing the country.
One way of doing this, apart from the co-opting of rituals like the ritual of a thousand monks, was to build, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And I wonder if you could talk about the way the sacred intersects with building and with art and decoration also in the Momoyama period.
Mm-hmm. Very closely, in a nutshell. But you can talk about it in terms of new construction and then preservation of old construction. The new construction is the one that, you know, we are most familiar with, or the one that you would immediately perhaps turn to. It's certainly what attracted me first to this building. It's a Momoyama building, and therefore I thought I was looking at something that was constructed for a specific purpose originally to serve on Chikubushima. Very quickly it became apparent to me that that wasn't the case, that even the building that is on Chikubushima is one that has undergone more than one life. In other words, mm-hmm. it was first built in Kyoto as a new structure. I'll talk about that in a moment. And then moved to Chikubushima and reconstituted as another building. So even new construction within, say, even a 20 or 30 year period undergoes changes. But the thing that I think I'll begin with, and I think which is kind of interesting in thinking about this kind of material in terms of art and architecture, mm-hmm. is the way that in the 16th and 17th century, patrons of art and architecture were interested in preserving old buildings mm-hmm. and old sculptures, for example. One of the ways that the Toyotomi showed themselves to be good benefactors and good rulers was to preserve ancient Buddhist precincts mm-hmm. and the buildings within them that they believed had been neglected. And so you have major precinct after major precinct that was preserved, conserved, where needed, rebuilt. And one could make an interesting study of, say, the pre-16th century, from, say, the 7th century up to the 16th century, of Buddhist and Shinto architectural sites, mainly Buddhist, in Japan that would not have been preserved, say, to the present day, had it not been for the reconstructive and conservation efforts that took place by the Toyotomi family. One of the interesting results of this is that in a recent conservation project at Horyuji, which is the oldest precincts in Japan, Buddhist precincts, they are thought to be the oldest wooden buildings in the world. When they took apart the pagoda, they realized that many of the wooden support structures placed at the different levels of the pagoda were actually put in the early 17th century by the Toyotomi family. And these are material remains of this reconstruction and preservation program. One of the things that's so interesting about what the Toyotomi did is they kept not only extensive records of these efforts, they created texts for each of these projects, which were then written down and probably announced and disseminated so that people around would know that the reason why, say, the Horyuji is still standing was because of the efforts of the Toyotomi. And this was articulated very clearly in the documents.
Interesting.
So, you know, there is that aspect of the relationship of political powers to the material side of the sacred realm. In terms of new construction, which was the other thing you asked about, there's no doubt that some of the most amazing buildings and programs of decoration that occurred in Japan, or certainly the most ambitious, took place because of the sponsorship of the Toyotomi clan, precisely because they wanted to prove that they could outdo what had been done before in the spiritual realm. In terms of size, the largest project that had occurred in Japan prior to this time was called the Great Eastern Temple, or the Great Buddha Hall at the Great Eastern Temple in Nara, built in the 8th century. And over the centuries, it had burned down and been rebuilt. And
this is a huge structure.
Huge, huge structure. I believe that the present building, which dates to a 17th century reconstruction effort after the Momoyama period, is, I believe, still the largest freestanding wood structure in the world. And it's smaller than the original one, which was built in the 8th century. At any rate, this place had been a major presence in Japan over the centuries, written about, painted, depicted, and always, you know, a central place in Japan's Buddhist landscape. What's interesting is that in the Momoyama period, the Toyotomi chose not to restore that building, mm-hmm. but rather to allow it to decay to a certain degree, and to build instead in Kyoto a great Buddha hall that was to replace, in a sense, the one in Nara. And this became the centerpiece of the Toyotomi's religious building project in Kyoto. The measure of its importance, perhaps, is the fact that after the Toyotomi were eventually defeated, the succeeding ruler, by decree, did not allow the place to be preserved so that it eventually self-destructed. That would be an example of new construction, along with an enormous sculpture of the Buddha inside, that speaks to the Toyotomi's pretensions to the sponsorship of sacred construction, both in terms of architecture as well as its decorative program inside. But then there are countless other examples as well that date from the period. And the building that I worked on, which is now on Chikubushima, is one example of that, and as I argue in the book, one of the best preserved from the period.
Can you talk just a bit about the concept of shogun and how it relates to this intersection of the aesthetic and the spiritual?
Shogun is a term which is a Buddhist term, basically, which describes sacred adornment. And it's a major concept or a major idea in Buddhism that one makes a Buddhist building and it should be resplendent, that one is meant to be impressed visually by the decoration, and that conveys something of the Buddhist aura. So that is interpreted in different ways over time, but I would argue that in the Momoyama period, one of the ways that it manifested itself was in the construction of buildings whose interiors were just resplendent with all manners of decoration, all mediums of decoration, painting, lacquer, sculpture. And it's not only the Momoyama period where this occurs. In other earlier periods, they used mirrors and reflective surfaces so that you would get this sense of an otherworldly, resplendent place.
So
and that is kind of sacred adornment.
There's a relation then between the sacred and the aesthetic, in a sense.
Yes, but again, you know, different Buddhist sects, different periods interpret that in different ways. Yeah. But yes, it's an important idea in Buddhist visual culture.
Now, about the building that you focus on, the temple at Shikibushima, you argue that the interior building was a small yet lavishly decorated, as you say, a funerary structure built for Hideyoshi's son, who died at a young age, and that it was disassembled and moved to Shikibushima, where it was reassembled inside the earlier main hall at a later date. And what's interesting about your argument, and this is perhaps the most notable aspect of your book, is the way you use multiple media and multiple frameworks of interpretation to make your case. And what's especially notable is that the effect of this isn't merely cumulative, but that these various perspectives interlock so that the whole essentially is greater than the sum of its parts. And this, I surmise, has to do with the fact that Momoyama art and culture itself relies on this idea of assemblage, which you do discuss in the book. So in a sense, the complexity of your object determines the complexity of your argument and methodology. So I wonder if you could talk about how it is you discovered the origin and original function of this inner building, and perhaps summarize the approaches used in your analysis of its structure and decoration and how they relate to one another. I know that's a huge question, but
you've covered it all there. The argument that the building that was moved to the island was originally built for Hideyoshi's son as a funerary structure is a hypothesis that I came to. And I'll talk about how I got to it more a little bit later. But I should say that the idea that the structure had been moved from Kyoto to the island is one that architectural historians had proposed, I guess, back in the 30s, when there was the first large-scale conservation of the place. It had been damaged during a typhoon, and they discovered inscriptions on the building which indicated that it had been moved. And you can tell when you look at the building that clearly that the present large building on the island is a composite of two structures, and the one that forms the interior now, the one that's heavily decorated, is a different structure than the one that encloses it, which is an earlier structure built on the island. There's plenty of evidence for that. Now, when I first started working on this project, again, as I said earlier, one of the things that drew me to it was the fact that the decorative program in the building is composed of so many different mediums, and that idea of working in many different mediums is something that I long found to be very important in dealing with Japanese art, to look at all the different mediums together. And I thought this would be a good monument through which to explore the importance of that approach of looking at the many different mediums. I should say that the common practice in Japanese art history, becoming less so now, but certainly when I started out, was that a scholar would be a specialist in one medium. You either work in painting, or you work in sculpture, or you work in lacquer, or architecture, and you don't work on all the different mediums together. So a common comment that I got when I started out and was researching this building was, well, what are you? Are you a painting specialist, or, you know, are you an architectural historian? And I would say, well, I'm interested in the arts of the Momoyama period, so I have to look at all these together. And certainly some people didn't find that approach to be admirable.
No.
But as I worked on the building and realized that, you know, it was an important approach to take, there were obvious formal relationships between the different mediums in the building, I also began to uncover almost unwittingly some meanings that would be unavailable unless you took that multiple medium approach. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I was, by virtue of just dumb luck, through friendships I had, I was offered the opportunity to study these two sets of armor that had been owned by Hideyoshi's young son. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't particularly interested in armor, but at the time I thought, but it was a great opportunity to examine these things. And I had previously worked on armor in an exhibition at the National Gallery, had befriended an armor expert, and this just seemed like a good opportunity. A curator at the Kyoto National Museum offered it to me, so I took it. In preparation for this examination with this friend of mine who was coming all the way up from Tokyo just to look at these two sets of armor, the two of us set about, in preparation, just finding out whatever we could about these two sets of armor. And in the process of doing so, I came across the name of a priest who had conducted apparently memorial services for the young boy who had owned the armor. And more just kind of looking, without really searching precisely for that, but just following up some leads, it turned out that the Kyoto University Library had one of the few copies of this priest's collected writings. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that they would lead anywhere, but I looked at them. It seemed like a good opportunity. And in the process of reading these collected writings, found that indeed he had written eulogies for this Hideyoshi's son, the owner of this armor. To make a long story short, I was starting to find pieces of information that I didn't think would initially be related to the decorative program in the building. But, for example, in these eulogies, the eulogies for this little boy, of which he wrote three different death anniversaries, he would compare the little boy to a flower, a particular flower, the fuyo, mm-hmm. a kind of hibiscus. And now, this had nothing to do with the armor,
yeah.
but it was the armor that took me yeah. unwittingly to this document. And I didn't even know what a fuyo was, but it seemed important mm-hmm. enough that he would mention it in relation to this little boy. And then I noticed he never used it for anyone else. He wrote eulogies for many, many people. He was a very well-placed priest. I put that aside. Mm-hmm. You know, we examined the armor. It was very interesting, and, you know, that kind of also got put aside. But then when I went back to the building later, I discovered, in fact, that there were depictions of plants on the building that had previously been identified as a much more common flower, the peony, mm-hmm. which appears all over the place yeah. in Japanese art. And everyone had said, well, that's what these are, and everyone assumed that that was the case. But when I started studying these flowers that were depicted in wood carvings, I realized, indeed, they weren't peonies yeah. because the leaves were much too large. So I started trying to look into what they were. I met a botanist, a scholar of botany at Kyoto University. He was an emeritus professor, and he took me into the storage rooms of Kyoto University's specimens collection, and we found, in fact, that these so-called peonies that I had photographs of from the building were not peonies at all, but they were a plant that he said, oh, yes, these are fuyo. Mm-hmm. And that was rather surprising to me. Mm-hmm. This, in other words, connected right back yeah. to those eulogies that I had completely, in another context, found. And so, in other words, the pieces of a puzzle that I didn't yeah. even realize I was looking for were beginning to come together.
Falling together. So and the fuyo has an iconographic significance related to, that relates to Hideyoshi's son.
Exactly. What it turned out was that the little boy died when he was three. Mm-hmm. And the fuyo is a plant that opens in the morning mm-hmm. and closes in the afternoon. Oh, so there's this association yeah. of kind of brevity of, yeah. of life, even though it opens again the next morning. But yeah. nonetheless, it has this particular association. It also is a flower of the eighth month, which mm-hmm. is the same month that the little boy died. So it would appear as though this flower was chosen as a metaphor for the little boy after he died mm-hmm. by this priest who used it in eulogies. It was not used for other people's eulogies for the entire 1590s. The little boy died in 1591. And so there is this iconographic link. Mm. Now, whether or not that link is precisely related to the building that I was working on was the next thing I need to look into. But because the building had been moved from Kyoto, mm-hmm. it had lost its original location, yeah. And so one didn't know where it was from. Yeah. The traditional association of the place is with Fushimi Castle, with mm-hmm. a castle that had been owned by Hideyoshi. There's zero evidence yeah. for that. But just about every building that was moved in the Momoyama period, and that's many, uh-huh. is said to have come from Fushimi Castle. This is simply yeah. a way of boosting tourism. Uh-huh.
It's interesting, then. This helped you to identify yes. probable...
Well, and that was just one piece of evidence. Yeah. And essentially what happened was I would get these little pieces of evidence that would point to this little boy, yeah. Stemaru. Yeah. And I would put it aside yeah. because I didn't realize that that's yeah. actually what it was all adding up to until quite a bit later. And I won't go through all yeah, of that. Yeah, it's in no. the book. But the point is that one of the points is, in relation to your original question, is that much of the iconography would not have added up mm-hmm. unless you looked at different mediums. Yeah. So, for example, the Fuyo iconography only shows up in the wood carvings. Uh-huh. Another motif that was closely related to the little boy only shows up in lacquer. Yeah. The painted, that is, the paintings on paper in the building, provide another piece of the puzzle, but they only show up in the paintings. And until you look at them together, you wouldn't arrive at a conclusion yeah. that would see them as being all part of one program.
Yeah. Yeah, very fascinating. When the structure is moved, then mm-hmm. presumably, and reassembled at mm-hmm. Shugabushima in the Great Hall, mm-hmm. It no longer then retains its original purpose.
Precisely. So mm-hmm.
what happens to its original iconography mm. and decorative program in this new context?
This is one of the things that I found most interesting. And the short answer is that it changes entirely, yeah. and purposely so. I mean, the point was, if indeed my conclusion is correct that the little building, the decorated part of the building, had been built in Kyoto as a memorial for the little boy Stemaru. If that is true, then it would be an appropriate structure to use as is for Chikubushima, which was dedicated to the Buddhist deity Benzai Ten, which has an entirely different, it's not a memorial kind of yeah. building, it's a building for a protective deity. Mm-hmm. So in the process of moving the structure and inserting it into a new context, it's clear that they also changed the iconographic program by hiding bits of it, by removing bits of it from view, and by actually moving parts of the building. It's a square building, so some parts are interchangeable. Uh-huh. By moving, switching sections of it to mix up the iconography. Uh-huh. And so, for example, the Fuyo flowers, of mm-hmm. which there had been four large panels on the exterior of an original possible eight. Mm-hmm. There were eight places on the exterior of the building that could hold large panels of carvings, two for each side of the building. Each side had one of those large panels of Fuyo carving, so from any direction that could have been seen originally. Well, they hid three of the four mm-hmm. when they moved it to the island, so no longer is the Fuyo quite so dominant. Uh-huh. Another motif that was linked to the little boy, which has a long history, but in the context, I argue, in Kyoto is linked to the little boy, Crane and Pine. Mm-hmm. Crane was on a beam, and the pine was on a pillar in lacquer mm-hmm. On the exterior of the building originally. The beam was moved to the other side of the building mm-hmm. when they moved it to the island, and then also placed behind a corridor. So it's practically invisible. And the only way that I was able to put them back together was just by measuring holes that were on the building and realigning them and realizing that originally the beams had been basically on different parts of the building and finding their original spots by virtue of holes that lined up.
Yeah. So does the iconography, as it's changed when the building is reassembled, mm-hmm. Reflect its new purpose as a temple for Benzai Ten?
Yeah, that's a good question. The answer would be yes, yeah. because of the concept that you brought up earlier, shogun, this idea of sacred adornment. One of the things that you find in temples for many different kinds of deities is this idea of having a resplendent interior. And that is one of the few things that does remain in effect in this building. And what they did was essentially silenced the iconography that was most clearly linked to the little boy to make sure that that was less apparent and allowed those parts that were less specific to the little boy to remain in place and therefore keep up the idea of Shogun, which could then be transferred as a proper setting for Benzai Ten. Yeah. So
I see.
It was very effective. The other thing that was so effective about it, there was one other motif that is all over the building that was not silenced, whether it was in Kyoto or on the island, and that was the family crest of the Toyotomi family. So that's prominent, and it remains in effect no matter where the building is. And it was one of the ways of showing, both in Kyoto and on the island, that the patron behind this project was the Toyotomi family in either case.
One thing you do that I found quite striking in the book that helps us to understand exactly what's happening here with this assemblage is that you talk about the Japanese tea ceremony and its aesthetics, and I wonder if you could relate the tea ritual to your interpretation of the site.
The reason I brought tea in there was really connected to the idea of assemblage, the idea that tea is one of the arts of Japan in which many different mediums need to be employed. And it's about the idea of taking a tea bowl and a tea jar and the various implements made of different materials, often with different provenances, which have very resonant meaning in Japan, the provenances themselves, and combining them in order to create a single assemblage. Mm-hmm. And every tea ceremony was a temporary creation, a performance of that moment that brought together these different mediums in order to create a single assemblage. In that sense, a place like Chikubushima and the building on it is an assemblage of different parts, whether of different mediums or actually of different buildings, that come together to create this unique assemblage. Yeah. The other reason why I brought in tea is because I knew that's where my next book was going to be, and it was a way of kind of testing some ideas that I wanted to work out in the next book.
Is the tea ceremony especially associated with the Momoyama period?
It is certainly associated with the Momoyama period. It begins earlier than the Momoyama period, but it's during the Momoyama period that some of its most famous practitioners lived. Sen no Rikyu, who's probably the most famous tea master of all time, lived in the Momoyama period. He was the tea master to Hideyoshi. But tea is something which has a history that precedes the Momoyama period and continues up to the present day. It's still a very active thing, but it's changed considerably over time. But many of the same players in this book on Chikubushima are the very same people that I'll be writing about in the next book, in which I do focus on tea.
So how has the structure at Chikubushima survived and fared in the post-Toyotomi period to the present day?
Benign neglect would be the term to use, perhaps, and unfortunately the neglect has become dangerous in more recent years. But basically what happened after the Momoyama period is that the center of Japan shifted from the Kyoto area, which encompasses Chikubushima. Chikubushima is, in a sense, the furthest extension of Kyoto, if you think of it as being that northeastern protective part, even though it's quite a distance from it. But the capital of Japan moved from Kyoto to the city of Edo, today's Tokyo, shortly after the Momoyama period ended, hence that's called the Edo period. And so the island itself, although continued to be and continues to this day to be a focus of religious attention, it was not as central or as important as it had been earlier. Interestingly, though, Chikubushima was recognized, even in the Edo period, as being a significant religious place. And so one of the things they did when they built the new city of Edo in the 17th century was to replicate Chikubushima in Edo. And if you go to Tokyo today, just next to the Ueno Zoo in Tokyo is the lake, a small pond, Shinobazu Pond.
Is this a man-made lake?
Pond is naturally occurring, but in the early 17th century, they built an island, and that is man-made. There's a whole description of it in diaries at the time, which was meant to be a replication of the island of Chikubushima. And that is there today. You can visit it. And the island of Chikubushima itself is one which one would have to say that it was not as important, although certainly locally it continued to be an important place, less so for Benzai Ten as it was for another practice on the island, which was the worship of another Buddhist deity, Kannon, a bodhisattva, and there are 33 pilgrimage sites associated with Kanon in western Japan, this area of Japan. And to this day, people still go to Chikubushima for that reason. But there are plenty of people who still think that Benzai Ten does reside on the island. That's another major, major focus still, pilgrims who go to the island. Historically, one other major shift that occurred in the island happened in the mid-19th century with the Meiji Restoration, the end of the Edo period. Prior to this time, Shinto and Buddhism, the two major religious traditions in Japan, had been intertwined, and Chikubushima was no exception. There were both Buddhist and Shinto elements on the island. One of the things they did in the Meiji Restoration was to artificially separate Buddhism and Shinto from each other. And this is a hard concept for some people to grasp, that two different faiths could be, in a sense, complementary and coexisting, but that was the reality in Japanese religion prior to the Meiji period. They separated them out in the Meiji period, mainly because Shinto was seen to be indigenous, Buddhist was seen to be foreign, so they separated them out, and as a result of that, Benzai Ten was forcibly removed from this building and moved to another structure on the island, and they made the building that had been a Benzai Ten hall into a Shinto building. Now, the fruit of that project remains to this day. Benzai Ten is no longer a resident officially within that building on the island, but still believers go there and pray to Benzai Ten because they know, in fact, that Benzai Ten, she's a female deity, resides there.
Interesting. When you say she was removed, this wasn't an object being removed. It was just
they removed scripturally, but also objects, sculptures of Benzai Ten. Oh, and as part of that Lotus Festival that we touched on slightly earlier, every single year they created a sculpture of Benzai Ten, and they're quite large sculptures. I don't know if you would say life-size, since I've never actually seen Benzai Ten. But in terms of human size, you know, a small human is about the size of them. Well, actually, they're pretty hefty, but good-sized sculptures. They were removed from the Benzai Ten Hall and lined up in another hall on the island, and you can see them there still today.
Is the shift of power from Kyoto to Edo and Tokyo, is this still reflected today, the rivalry between these two power centers?
Well, whether it's a rivalry or not, there is certainly still some sense of distance between them. When I first started doing this research, I had a lot of documents that had been published, the Chikubushima Monjo, or Chikubushima documents as they're called, and I'd gone through them enough in order to see that there was a lot of information that needed to be teased through and thought about. After Hideyoshi dies, the major ruler of the Toyotomi family, he dies in 1598. Now, the Edo period, you know, depending on how you frame it, begins right after Hideyoshi dies or shortly thereafter, or some people would push it up to 1615, which is the final destruction of the Toyotomi family. Well, because of the research that I was doing, it seemed pretty clear to me, and is one of the major arguments of the book, that the Toyotomi family remained relevant until 1615, and that's actually the entire second half of the book. When I first went to Japan, I didn't realize that that was the case. I was still a little fuzzy about how to understand that period of history. But I did have these documents, which seemed to suggest that there was something to be looked at, in other words, in relation to this family. When I first went to Japan to do my research, I first went to Tokyo. The University of Tokyo is a major research institution. I had an affiliation there, and so I went there. And when I discovered that many people were very unreceptive to what I was doing, and they'd say, well, don't you realize that the Toyotomi family was irrelevant after Hideyoshi died? And I'd say, but we have these documents here, don't they, you know, shouldn't we look at them? And they'd say, it's a waste of time.
That's interesting.
Eventually, I kept going at it anyway, and I moved to Kyoto really mostly to be closer to the island, and I also had an affiliation at Kyoto University there, so I moved and found, surprising to me at the time, that scholars in Kyoto were very interested in the fact that I was looking at these post-Hideyoshi documents. And it struck me very quickly that one of the reasons that was true is because in doing so, what I was asserting was that the dominance of the family that eventually came to rule in the Edo period, what I was arguing was that they were less prominent until 1615. And that's something that people in Kyoto like to hear.
Yeah.
Whereas people in Tokyo apparently like to hear that, well, immediately after Hideyoshi dies, this family takes over and and that's that.
It's interesting. It's funny. I mean, I suppose not surprising if you think about Southern scholars and Northern scholars and their different takes on the Civil War.
But, oh, absolutely.
But we're talking about the 17th century here, not
the 1860s. No. Well, this old history, this is still considered relatively recent history in Japan. So, this is not old stuff for them.
So, last question. Your book is in part a documentary study insofar as you cite and quote extensively from primary historical materials, and you include translations of important pertinent documents in the appendices. And this is a program where we're interested in examining the research process and the way libraries and archives are used in scholarship. So, can you tell us about your experience of working in Japanese libraries?
Quite varied. I mentioned before, for example, that text that had the eulogies written by the Buddhist priest who wrote the eulogies for the little boy's funeral and memorial ceremonies. That was in a rare book room in Kyoto University. And when I discovered that they had this book by looking in the various bibliographic references, you know, that was a case of working with a book that exists in very few copies.
Yeah.
So basically being with a curator of the collection in a room, I was allowed to handle the book, but told I couldn't copy it. When I worked with that book,
Is it a manuscript?
It was a woodblock printed manuscript.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. This is a very common thing for priest literature, to have the writings of the priest collected and then printed as a woodblock printed book. So it exists in any number of copies, perhaps, but not a great number, and not that many have been preserved.
Yeah.
And although he was a major religious figure in the 16th century, he's not someone who's a kind of household name.
Yeah.
So working in a rare book room in Japan was actually quite exciting, because you're able to hold in your hands the text that very few people have seen, and there aren't that many copies of it. But even more so, and that's a woodblock printed book, many of the documents that I worked with, especially the ones that I include transcriptions of, are texts that only exist in manuscript form. And like anything in Japan, a lot of what one gets to do as a scholar has to do with access that's granted to you by helpful scholars or curators in museums or in collections. And without the help of these curators and other historians, I would never have been able to do what I did. And I must acknowledge the tremendous amount of help that I received from these people, and it was really exciting. I mean, to be holding the letter that Hideyoshi wrote and to work with it is a real gift. Japanese historians and institutions preserve their history very assiduously.
Even with all the destruction that's
with
taken
all the
place
destruction,
in libraries and temples.
Yes, what does remain is taken care of very, very well, and in fact, near Chikubushima is this place called Nagahama, which was actually the town from which Hideyoshi had his first fief, where he lived, and from where he made his excursions to Chikubushima. There's a reconstruction of the castle there, which is now a museum, and that is the place that essentially takes care of the documents related to Chikubushima. On the other hand, there is an archive, I know, a trove of documents that still remain on Chikubushima that neither I nor anyone else that I any scholars I know who are interested in Chikubushima have been able to access.
And these aren't state documents, then. They're controlled.
Controlled by the island and by the religious establishment there. You know, maybe 10, 20, 30 years from now, maybe someone will have an opportunity to really examine them.
Yeah.
So there's still information to be found, I'm sure. And I hope someday that, I don't know if I'll be the one who gets to go in there, but someone will.
So I want to thank you, Andy, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been fun. We've been talking with Andrew Watsky, professor of art at Vassar College, about his book entitled Chikubushima, Deploying the Sacred Arts in Momoyama, Japan. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM, Poughkeepsie. I'm your host, Thomas Hill.